accession number 15111, reel 4.
Wing Commander Higginson, reel 4. You were just telling me about how you got help from a vicar in Abbeville.
Yes, Paul Cole took me to see this chap. He had the means, the stamps and that sort of thing, to make French identity cards. And he made one for me. We then set off the next day for the frontier exit where the Germans used to man. It was one end of a bridge, and once you had your identity card, you had to present your identity cards on the French side, on the zone interdite side, and then over the bridge, and you are into zone occupée, which is what Paul and I did. And then we made our way by train to Paris. We had to stay the night in Paris, and we went to what I would call is a brothel, but we didn't book in, and this is why we could stay there, because there was no record kept of anybody who was in the building at the time. And so we had a room each in this brothel. In the middle of the night or thereabouts, I had to go to the loo. And the loo in this case was a hole in the floor, wasn't a sit and comfortable unit as we have in the UK. It was merely a hole in the floor which you squatted over and performed. Having done this, I went back into my room, and the morning arrived, and I went to check my money, my identity card, and all the other bits and pieces which I was taking with me, and lo and behold, I couldn't find any of my papers. So I got into a bit of a panic and sat down and thought and thought. Then I realized I'd been to the loo, and I went back there, put my hand down and there, and told it had got down through the hole, and I had to extract it, the identity cards, all these sort of things, and brought them back into my room. I washed them in the sink and put them on the floor where the sun was shining through so they could dry. And as a result of that, we had to delay our departure for some time, and eventually they were dry enough for us to proceed. We then caught another train we got down from Paris down to
Lyon?
No.
To La Montferre?
No. It was on the frontier between the zone occupée and zone libre. And it was a village about 2 miles away from the place where we could cross, the frontier being marked again by a river. And Paul told me that if we called at the post office in this village, we would be told what time the German patrols had passed the point we were making for, and we could then proceed. Well, in fact, when we went there, the shop was closed, the post office was closed. We have had a discussion, Paul and I, and we agreed whether we agreed to go, whether or not we knew what time they were going to be there. So the road we were walking on, and it was a bright sunlight day, we were walking in line astern on this road, and we eventually came to the river. And looking across the river, on a piece of ground up somewhat higher than we were, was a cafe. Just 5 minutes or so after we'd arrived at this road and were still deciding whether we should swim over or what we should do, there was a farm opposite on the left-hand side, and a woman came out with a boat and rowed across. She was the farmer's wife, apparently, and rowed across the river towards us, and we asked her for a lift. We jumped in the boat, and she rowed us across, and we were more than grateful and thought, well, that's fine, let's settle that. And then we went up a little path to join the main road again. And just as we got to the junction of the path of the main road, who should appear but a German officer and a German sergeant. And they'd obviously been watching us. We didn't know that at the time, of course. And they started to ask questions, and Paul, whose French was a little better than mine, but not a great deal better, was saying, oh, well, you take me to the commandanteur and I will report you for drinking at my aunt's cafe. And the sergeant then pointed at me and he said, he's not a Frenchman, he's not talking. So the officer said, let me see your identity card. So I gave him my identity card. He showed it to the sergeant. He said, look, that's all right. He gave it back to me. In the meantime, I had under my arm, I suppose you'd call it a briefcase. It was a sort of bent case, a case in half, you know, like a book made of leather or some material like that. And in this, I had a spare pair of socks, pants, and I had some chocolate I had bought in the hotel. And Paul had a briefcase, and he had a revolver, and he had the times of the trains going from Lille to the Russian front. So he, number of trains a day and what time they went and all that. And he was saying, come on, let us go. I'll tell you to put... And the sergeant once again pointed at me and he said, look, he's not talking. The officer said to me, open your briefcase. So I laid it on the ground, opened it, and that chocolate had run all over the place. And Paul turned around and said, I told you he's a fool. Look at his identity card. He's a fool. He's marked down as a fool. A fool. A fool. He was speaking French, of course, all the time. So the officer looked at it and said, push off. So I picked up my briefcase and I walked down the road. A little time later, I went down about 100 yards or so around a bend and hid in a bit of woodland. And about 5 or 10 minutes later, Paul came down the road and I joined him around the bend, and we went off and then got a train. I've got the ticket somewhere for the ticket on that train down to Marseille. There has been some suggestion since then that Paul was already a traitor at that time, but the fact that he did this was done in order that, you know, he could declare that he was a pretty good, clean, honest chap. Anyway, we got down then to Marseille, and we first of all accommodated in a house which was owned by a man called Dr. Rodakanaki, and he had an English wife. And the 2 days I was there, she was absolutely super. When it was time for supper or lunch, she would give me her arm and we'd walk into their dining room, and there was severe rationing on. The food was in very short supply, and what we had to eat wasn't was nothing virtually. Anyway, I was very impressed with both of them, and I believe now the street has been named Dr. Rodakanaki. Anyway, while we were there, we had a visit from Patrick O'Leary, who was a Belgian doctor, medical doctor, and he had apparently got down to Marseille and he'd taken over what was then an organization which was trying to help English people escape, and which was run by, oh dear, I can't remember his name now, Scotsman.
Yes, I know, I've forgotten his name as well. Never mind, it's on the record.
Is it? Yeah. And while I was in the house of Dr. Rodakanaki, it was at the time that the communication between the UK and France was then done by what you call a tap-tap-tap thing.
Morse
code, that's right. And they communicated with London through Morse code. And obviously Patrick O'Leary's past had been investigated. And they said, Patrick, do arresti, which means Patrick could stay. Ian Garrow, that was the name of the chap. He could take over from Ian Garrow, and the other man whose name I forget, trying to organize escape at that time. And Patrick then took us from Dr. Kanati, Rodakanaki, to the port of Marseille itself, to a house owned by René and Louis Nouveau. He was an author, a writer, and he had in fact translated Shakespeare into English, and they had a flat overlooking the bay, and you could see the sea and all that sort of thing. And I stayed there for a few nights when Patrick decided to I should perhaps break for a second here to say that my wife had received a letter from the Quakers that there was a man called Captain Basil Bennett in the south of France, and was anxious to tell her that he was safe and well. And this message was received apparently on the 12th of August, 56 days after I was shot down. After spending a little time in Louis and René Nouveau's flat, Patrick decided to move me down to the front, to the Spanish frontier, and he got a Spanish guide to accompany me, and we got on the train in Marseille. And then we got off the train at Banyuls-sur-Mer, and there was a queue to go out of the station, which I joined, And when I came, I was the last in the queue, because I didn't realize that it was necessary to queue and necessary to line up. Anyway, the gendarmes who were on the exit looked at my card and said, "What are you doing down here? Your card says you're from Pas-de-Calais." I said something about looking for my family or worse than that, if I can't remember what it was. And they, anyway, it didn't satisfy them. And I ended up in solitary confinement in the police station. I was there, I can't remember how many days. Anyway, occupy the time, I remember catching big flies, pulling their wings off, and making them run along a piece of the bed I was on a wooden bed, piece of the bed I was sitting on, but I had nothing else to do. And after a few days there, I was moved then to after a few days in solitary confinement in this military prison, they moved me to this civil prison at Perpignan, was a most dreadful place. I've been back since, when I played rugby for the combined services against France B, and it hasn't changed a bit. What it amounted to, it was a building with a ground floor and one upper floor, all stone. And the first day I was there, there were about 30 or 40 other prisoners there, if not more, one of whom, and this gives you an indication of the French justice, inverted commas, one of whom had been in a brothel, and when he came downstairs, he found that the girl had taken all his money, so he pulled a knife out and killed her on the spot. He was sentenced to 7 years in prison. Another of the prisoners there stole the golden candlesticks from Nîmes Cathedral, and he was given a life sentence. So, it's hardly what you call justice. Anyway, the time in the daytime there was spent just sitting on the stone floor. And if you had money, as one of the prisoners had, obviously, you were allowed to have a food sent in. And when this chap's food arrived every day, the rest of the prisoners, I didn't know what on earth they were doing the first day, the rest of the prisoners sat on the floor around him, and when he'd finished, I think it was peaches, there was some fruit like a peach, which grows in plenty of supply in that part of the world, and he'd eat the outside and then toss the stone in the air, and they'd fight for the stone. When he'd got the stone, he would break it open, there's a nut inside. And the reason they did this, because we didn't get fed. All I got was one bowl of what they call soup a day and a half a slice of bread, and that's all. My fighting weight normally is about 11 and a half stone. I'm still that weight now, and always have been. And when I boxed for the efforts, I was still 11 and a half stone. And I went down to 7 stone in this place. After I'd been there for a little while, I think it was about 3 months or so, I was told that Marshal Pétain had granted me a parole, and I was to be released and taken to a prison camp, or at least it was an internment camp called Saint Hippolyte du Four. So the gendarmes arrived, and I was locked in handcuffs, went on the train with them, and they then handcuffed me to the door of the train, where they themselves opened their satchels and pulled out some very attractive food, which they proceeded to enjoy, and they didn't even throw me a crumb. Anyway, we got into Saint-Hippolyte IV, and that was an internment camp. and we weren't there for very long. I imagine that what was happening was that politically they were trying to decide what to do with people like myself and others who weren't in the civil prison. And they then moved us by train, under guard, of course, to an Italian, French-Italian frontier fortress called Fort della Rovere. It is a fortress above the heights in Nice, and it is a big round fortress with a moat and a drawbridge and very securely guarded. After some time there, where Whitney Strait was at that time the senior British officer, and the British officers, there were about a dozen of us altogether, I can't remember the number in total, mostly Army, some Air Force, and there was a New Zealander there, and two New Zealanders, Gary Barnett was the officer, and Hickton was the NCO pilot. Anyway, we were, if you can imagine, you cross over the drawbridge, and there's a big arch, and on the right-hand side is a huge, long building and with a long passageway. On each side of the passageway, there were accommodation for the people, and a gate, of course, at the end of the passageway where the archway finished, and likewise on the other side. The officers were accommodated on the left, and the other ranks accommodated on the right. Whitney Strait, I believe, was still held at that time. He still had an American passport, although he had been shot down fighting for the RAF and the UK. He'd been shot down as a pilot, but I believe he still had an American passport. Anyway, shortly after I arrived there, before that, we started to get then Red Cross parcels, and there were cigarettes in them and food, and we had a sort of arrangement with some of the soldiers where we'd exchange some English cigarettes for a bit of food or something of that kind. And we had, a talking relationship with these guards. Whitney was then, as I heard later on, transferred to a hospital somewhere in Marseille, I think. And he escaped from there and got back home before me. And I was left as senior British officer. I set about then getting a team together, an escape team, to see how we could get out of the place. And in this team I had Sergeant Nabarro, Hickton, Gary Barnett, hang on please, and Brian Hawkins, who was a flight lieutenant, we tried to evolve a plan of escape. And I noticed one day that looking over the wall which separated the end of the rooms from the moat, you could look down into the moat, and looking down into the moat near the drawbridge, I saw that there was a hatch like a drain cover, and the drawbridge itself was supported by two large vertical round pillars, and this was at the bottom of the first one, and I thought, I wonder what that is. It might be the water drains or something like that. So anyway, we set about getting Red Cross parcel string and tying it all up into a kind of rope. Obviously, it wouldn't be a proper rope, but it would take some of the weight. And we got some V caps. I can't remember what you call them now, but the caps we had in those days. And we made them into gloves, and the thing that we decided to do was to go in the kitchen, get into the kitchen. To do that, we had to drop down through a hole which was on the door where the entrance archway through, and it was used for dropping food and stuff down, but it had barbed wire in it, so we had to make clothes of which the barbed wire could scratch down when we fell through. And we decided to get down into the kitchen and try and lever the window in the kitchen and a round archway atop, two horizontal pieces of metal, bars of metal, and about eight vertical bars. And obviously the longest bar above the vertical was where the archway was the highest. So we had to devise some means of breaking that, and I don't know who it was who thought about the idea, but we got hold of a magnet, and we got some wood and jammed it in the magnet, and then put a with a poker burnt a hole through there, and we put that over the top when we came to escape, put that over the top, and it worked well. Anyway, on the we were at this time also. We were able to communicate with Patrick by a priest, Padre Mirda, M-Y-R-D-A, who was a Polish priest. I had moaned like hell, complained to the warden, the boss of the guards, that we didn't have any church services. We had no Bibles and nothing of that sort at all. And I was attempting to try and rewrite the Bible, put the prayer book, our prayer book, remember the prayers. And then, as a result of our pressure, they agreed that Padre Mirda could come and see us. I forget how often it was, once a month or something like that. And they didn't know, of course, that Padre Mirda was in touch with Patrick O'Leary. So we then told Padre Mirda on one of his visits what we were proposing to do, and he said okay, he would arrange for a hideout in Monte Carlo, which was not so far away, where we could be hidden, and if we got down to the station, nearest railway station to Monte Carlo, nearest to the fort itself, then he would have somebody sent there to pick us up. So we chose a particular day, and on that day we organized for the other ranks to have a concert, because every time we had a concert, the guards either that were on duty on the drawbridge would wander down and look over to see who was singing or making the noise and so on. In other words, we distracted the guards by the concert. And then we went, dropped through the barbed wire in the hole into the kitchen quite successfully. We left behind a couple of old battle dress tops which were caught in the barbed wire, and got into the kitchen across the other side to the moat, and there were, as we had worked out, this particular grill, put the magnet over the top, pulled it two or three times, and we broke three or four projections above the vertical in the middle of the arch, and then we dropped down into the moat one by one and got underneath the drawbridge. So we